for bitmap graphic output. Atkinson had also, over the objection of some of the hardware engineers on the project, successfully lobbied for Lisa to operate on a paper paradigm. That meant that the background color of the screen would be white, not the null void of almost every other computer except the Alto. The hardware people hated this because a white screen was prone to video flicker. To avoid the problem, the computer would have to refresh the phosphors on the screen much more often. This process would require Lisa to become more powerful, and therefore more expensive. But the result would be worth the cost. Lisa would presumably encourage office workers to produce documents blending text and graphics. If the screen background were black, the graphics would resemble photo negatives. People would be unable to visualize what they really looked like until a document was printed. Also, people were comfortable putting dark marks on a white paper, and a computer that provided them with that comfort would be a welcome departure from the current vaguely hostile dark background computer monitors. In the excitement generated after the park visit, Jobs and one of his lieutenants, Trip Hawkins, who later would found Electronic Arts, a software company that devised some extremely slick computer games, wrote up a new plan for the project, focused on implementing the key Engelbart Park innovations: Windows, icons, mouse. Though the computer would still be marketed to office professionals, this represented a different philosophical underpinning. Lisa was now destined to vivify what personal computers could be. By elaborating on Xerox's paradigm, Apple would have a computer that instantly rendered every single one of Apple's competitors as an antique. This proposed shift in course was not a given. Even though Jobs, as co-founder and chief stockholder of Apple, had considerable power, it was understood that his youth and impetuousness relegated him to a subordinate role to Apple's chairman Mike Markola and president Mike Scott. To the latter, the opinions of the former Hewlett-Packard engineers on the Lisa team were regarded at least as highly as those of Steve Jobs, and the HP people thought that, as impressive as the Alto was, it was rather presumptuous, if not downright flaky, for Apple to attempt to duplicate the feat in a low-cost personal computer. Presumption, however, was Jobs' forte. He and those sympathetic to his vision lobbied furiously. With Xerox's permission, they commissioned their own mouse from Jack Hawley, a Berkeleyite who had left Park to open a business called Mouse House, purveyors of fine digital mice to an exclusive clientele since 1975. They dubbed it the Clandestine Mouse. Bill Atkinson quickly hacked a driver program that allowed the mouse to move a cursor on the computer screen. Jobs and Hawkins proceeded to dazzle skeptics with the power of the pointing device. The mouse triumphed. A torch had been passed. The nexus of 20 years and millions of dollars of government and top-level corporate research was now in the hands of a company that only a few years ago had operated out of a garage. Apple's task was to take this technology out of the lab and into general circulation. Bill Atkinson quickly learned how difficult this would be. His job on the project was to generate the routines that would control the display, the software equivalent of heavy lifting. An intense bearded engineer named Rich Page was his hardware counterpart. At 28, Atkinson had established himself as one of the true wizards in the company. Before coming to Apple, he had been a graduate student combining computer science and neurobiochemistry at the University of Washington, gaining distinction by concocting a graphics program that interpreted CAT scans of the human brain. The stunning visuals produced by Atkinson's work allowed people to see the brain from previously unimagined vistas. Atkinson had experienced a conversion experience when he came across an Apple II in 1977. He easily saw past its limitations. It was much less powerful than the machines he worked with at school. Instead, appreciating the virtuosity of Steve Wozniak's digital design. He went to work for Apple in 1978. Employee number 51, writing applications would help sell the Apple II. But with Lisa, Atkinson faced his biggest challenge. His 90-minute exposure to Smalltalk had been somewhat deceiving. while the computer in some ways seemed to have completely solved the challenge of allowing an unschooled worker easy access to the information inside the computer, the furniture of cyberspace, when Atkinson sat down and tried to duplicate the task, he realized that there were gaps as yet unfilled. Specifically, there was the question of what was known as clipping. It had to do with the phenomenon of overlapping windows. When you opened a window, resized the window, or moved one, what happened underneath? Did the computer have to perform all the work of drawing the windows you did not see, or was there a way that it could save energy by drawing only the part of the display the viewer saw at a given moment? During the park visit, Atkinson was impressed that Smalltalk somehow knew how to show only the visually relevant information at any given millisecond. The irony is that Atkinson was mistaken. The Alto had used a much less elegant and slower method than clipping. But buoyed by what he thought was Smalltalk's existence proof of clipping, Atkinson kept hammering at a solution. He wanted a system for Lisa whereby those hidden regions would redraw so quickly that the user would have the illusion that everything really was on the screen at once. Atkinson worked at the problem for months, not only in long hours at a desk, but literally in his dreams. Upon rising, he would record his somnambulant labors in a notebook. Eventually, wave after wave of Atkinson's brain power eroded the problem. He had set out to reinvent the wheel. Actually, he wound up inventing it. His solution dealt with sophisticated use of algebra to calculate which regions of the window had to be drawn and remembered. For a time, Atkinson was the only person in the world who understood the voodoo by which those regions could so quickly display overlapping windows. This lack of redundancy was almost disastrous. On his way to Apple one morning, Atkinson failed to notice that the tractor trailer ahead of him was parked. He drove his RX-7 straight underneath it, shearing off the top of the sports car, which wound up on the other side of the huge truck. The subsequent call to emergency services reported a decapitation. Fortunately, Atkinson's head, at the time the sole repository of the secret for representing cyberspace on a computer screen, remained in place, though for a brief period rather dysfunctional. He awoke in a hospital room. Steve Jobs was staring at him with concern. "Don't worry, Steve," he said. "I still know how to do regions." Atkinson's breakthrough was the bedrock of a set of graphic routines he called LisaGraph, later renamed to the more generic QuickDraw. These were the heart of the Lisa display, and eventually the Macintosh. QuickDraw made the Macintosh graphic-friendly, Atkinson told me some years later. That's what made it an environment fertile enough to do PageMaker. In mid-1980, Larry Tesler, late of Park, joined the Lisa project and eventually was joined by other Xerox refugees, including Owen Densmore and Steve Capps. The computer scientists made for an interesting contrast with the professional engineers from HP, not to mention the personal computer hackers who embodied the improvisational Apple style. The Lisa project became characterized by discussion, a carryover from the beanbag chair colloquies at Park. Steve Jobs was no longer with the project. Apple had been reorganized, and former HP manager John Couch had been named the head of the professional office systems division from which Lisa was developed. The underlying motive for the switch was getting Jobs out of the building. His impulsive management style and overbearing ego were driving people crazy. Also, the company's top executives, cautious in their first assault on the corporate world, were concerned that Jobs, at 25, did not have the experience to sell into that cloistered conservative market. A few months later, Jobs' disappointment was slightly mitigated by his elevation to Apple's chairman of the board. By the time Tesler came on board, Lisa's hardware design was completed, or in geek terminology, frozen. Lisa now presented a pleasant, if beetle-browed visage with his 12-inch screen located to the left of two slots for floppy disks that would run on the ill-conceived Twiggy disk drives. The Twiggies were unreliable artifacts of Apple's hubristic desire to do even needlessly difficult things in-house instead of relying on technology perfected by outside specialists. A detached keyboard in a deep beige hard plastic casing rested under a beveled overhang underneath the screen. But the software, particularly the interface, was up for grabs. The design process was evolutionary. Every aspect of the operating system exposed to the user was subject to a series of incremental improvements. These would be punctuated by clever, sometimes brilliant, mutational innovations. Driving the process was the ongoing debate over what might be the very best face Lisa could put forth. Even the slightest interface aspect could trigger a heated debate, with adherents of opposing solutions arguing with near Jesuitical intensity. With good reason. When an interface is exposed to millions of users, even the most minor inconsistency can be amplified to a consistently infuriating annoyance. To this day, the bone that sticks most deeply in the craw of Apple and Macintosh designers is the charge that all their interface work simply consisted of making, no pun intended, a Xerox copy of the work they saw at Park. Indeed, the same issue was raised in a lawsuit filed by Apple against the software developer Microsoft when Apple complained that Windows, Microsoft's own visual interface, owed a suspicious debt to Lisa and Macintosh. According to Gates, the biography of Microsoft's chairman, when Steve Jobs first accused Bill Gates of stealing Apple's ideas, he shot back, "No, Steve, I think it's more like we both have this rich neighbor named Xerox, and you broke in to steal the TV set, found I'd been there first, and said, 'No fair, I wanted to steal the TV set.'" A look at the evolution of the Lisa interface, however, shows that much more was involved than lifting a Trinitron from Xerox's living room. With the discipline of the marketplace looming over them, Lisa's engineers realized that Park's ideas had to be stripped down and rebuilt to more demanding specifications. By the time Tesla arrived in mid-1980, Apple had already clarified some of Park's ideas, making them friendlier to novice users. One of the primary differences was the implementation of something called direct manipulation, the ability to reach into cyberspace and get things done without any mediation. In the Park world, things mostly got done by moving the cursor over selections on pop-up menus. With Lisa, however, you can manipulate almost anything on the screen, often without reverting to the middleman of menus. Xerox never had the concept of direct manipulation, Tesla later explained. Even with the star, you couldn't drag a window around. You couldn't drag an icon around. To resize a window, you had to use a menu. Atkinson had the idea of dragging those around. As a former member of Alan Kay's learning research group, Tesla understood the irony. Striving to make computers accessible, Kay had been designing for children and had steered the nature of computer interaction away from obscurity on the golden road towards intuitiveness. But he didn't go far enough. It took the street hackers of Apple to go the final mile. Alan Kay thought Smalltalk was for kids and it was simple. A 14-year-old could do it. But Bill wanted it simpler, Tesla later recalled. Tesla's comment reveals the extent to which Bill Atkinson influenced the design of Lisa's human interface. Because Atkinson wrote the software that controlled the objects on the screen, the visual part of the interface, he had a strong voice in debates. When Tesla arrived, he became chairman of the Lisa User Interface Council, consisting of himself, Atkinson, and the most receptive marketing representative they could find. A pattern emerged. An engineer, usually Atkinson or one of his cronies, would propose an unusual innovation. The marketers, fearing yet another time-consuming rewrite of the software, would object. They would be joined by the HP contingent, a cautious lot sensitive to all sorts of blasphemies against previously held wisdom. At the point of impasse, Tesla would turn to Atkinson and ask how long it would take to implement the feature, quick and dirty. "Tomorrow," Bill would say. The next day, after an all-night hack, Atkinson would have a prototype. Then they'd test it. User testing was Larry Tesler's fetish. Since this was supposed to be the first computer the virgin users could begin using as soon as it landed on their desks, the people testing could not yet have been initiated into the mysteries of digital culture. Fortunately, Apple in those days was hiring boxcars full of new employees, many of them as secretaries, janitors, marketers, and accountants. They'd never touched the computer. Tesla had a connection at the new employee orientation sessions held on Mondays, who recruited newcomers for user testing sessions at Lisa's Bandley 2 headquarters, B before they got contaminated with exposure to other computers, Tesla later noted. He'd sit a virgin before Lisa and conduct controlled experiments on isolated features. First, do it this way, now that way. After four or five testers had slithered through this interface maze, the correct solution would usually emerge. This give-and-take system yielded some marvelous digital artifacts that distinguished Lisa and later found their way to Macintosh. Take the menu bar, that row of words that rests on the white space at the top of every Macintosh application. If you move the cursor over one of the words, like File, Edit, Font, or Special, you get Apple's successor to Xerox PARC's pop-up menu, the pull-down menu. This drops like a window shade with a list of words representing a command that will be enacted when the cursor finds its way over the proper word. As it turns out, Bill Atkinson did not originally plan for a menu bar on top of the screen. It sort of migrated upward, like cream rising to the top. Atkinson wanted the commands to be geographically predictable, the same place in every application. For that reason, he rejected pop-up windows. Then he got the idea of a menu bar, a constant presence from which one could evoke a menu of commands by pointing and clicking. At first, he put the bar at the bottom of the active window, then, after some testing, moved it to the top. But putting the menu bar on top of a window presented a problem. When the user shrank the size of the window, you couldn't get the headings to fit. Microsoft's Windows uses this approach and suffers by it. So finally, at Tesla's urging, he moved it to the top of the screen. Users quickly learned where the commands were under the individual headings, and Atkinson was impressed that they could implicitly visualize where a command might live on the screen, moving the mouse over the heading, dropping down the menu, and going right to the location in one fell swoop. It was a case of totally internalizing the illusion of geography and cyberspace. You would go to a menu choice that really didn't exist until you created it. Then there was the mouse button war. To outsiders, the issue of how many buttons on a mouse is as arcane as how many angels can be jammed on the head of a pin. But debates about mouse buttons are impassioned and urgent. As Bill Gates once told me, the number of buttons on a mouse is one of the most controversial issues in the industry. People get religious. In 1971, when Bill English and a couple of other SRI workers left Doug Engelbart to pursue the bitmap dream at Xerox PARC, the mouse retained its three buttons, red, yellow, and blue. But in preparation for the star, Xerox tested a number of mouse variations on new users and found two buttons to be a felicitous number. One button was used for selecting things, the other button to extend the selections. As had Xerox, Apple tested many variations of the mouse, experimenting not only with buttons, but the mouse's size and shape. Ergonomic comfort was important. In 5 years of use, the modest increments of mouse travel on a desktop or pad could total up to a journey between 25 and 30 miles. Industrial designer Jerry Manick once estimated that they tried 150 models of mice, broken up in wine-tasting sessions of about 25 each. One variation was shaped like a golf ball. Apple finally decided that smaller was better and shagged the so-called Arnold Palmer model. While the initial version of the Macintosh mouse was indeed tiny compared to the brickish Engelbart original, it was still comparatively boxy, and Apple standardized a sleeker version some years later. The results were more interesting in the button competition. When Apple tested a two-button mouse, Tesla recalled, people made a lot of mistakes. With two buttons, they'd be constantly turning their heads from the screen and looking at the mouse. I'd say, hit the button. And they'd say, which button? Which button? When we did experiments with identical everything except the number of buttons on the mouse, the people who used the one-button mouse said it was easier to pick up. I realized that when you used the mouse, they were pointing and tapping the button with the finger they were pointing with. There was no mental model for pointing with more than one finger, so we got rid of the second button. I wrote a memo called One Button Mouse. Unlike some of his former colleagues, for Tesla, the conversion to a single button did not engender a spiritual crisis. Apple's interest in Lisa, he would later explain, was getting systems to lay people, not computer experts. His apostasy was repulsive to the Xerox people. The one-button mouse was a mistake, Bill English said. Why would you want to limit yourself like that? But Apple's mouse really wasn't limited. Instead of multiple buttons, the Lisa mouse, and the Macintosh mouse that followed, let you use the single button in different ways, by the number of times you click the button. There were single clicks and double clicks, like a coded shorthand, one if by land and two if by sea. The Macintosh listened to see if the user clicked once or twice on the mouse. As with many skills required to use the Macintosh, this may sound complicated, but is actually rather intuitive. The word processing program at Xerox, it used double clicks to select words, but the Lisa group used that function for other things as well, particularly for launching applications, and it was further refined on Macintosh. One learns rather quickly which commands are double clickers and which are single clickers. Selecting a file is a single click. Launching the file requires a double click. In text editing, moving the cursor is a single click, but if you place the cursor on a word, double-clicking the mouse highlights that word. A few years after the Macintosh's introduction, a group of third-party programmers designing a hot new word processor decided to implement triple-clicking. Click three times fast, an entire paragraph would be selected. This evolutionary wrinkle caught on, and now is a semi-standard used by several word processing programs. Do people sometimes fail to hit the button quickly enough for the second click? They sure do. Do trigger happy mousers sometimes do an index finger stutter and double click when they meant only to click once? Yes. Double clicking isn't a perfect trade-off for the simplicity of a one-button mouse, and the mouse button debate still rages. On the other hand, I always find it extremely comforting to actually see the result of a double click launch. That was one of the great things about both the Lisa and the Macintosh. Apple makes it into a little entertainment event, complete with animation, when the window zooms out from the icon like the beginning of a Looney Tunes episode. That process of moving the pointer with the mouse over an icon representing an application, double-clicking, and watching a work window open up, was only one of many original innovations that the Lisa interface team added to the bedrock of the Smalltalk paradigm. The wildest change did not come until 1982. When Lisa was almost ready to have its code frozen at last. It concerned the filer, the program that would greet every user as soon as he or she flicked on the machine. From filer, you would launch programs, copy files, name them, and perform other housekeeping tasks. Yet, as the shipping date approached, many of the designers were unhappy with the filer. Every time a user named a file, saved a file, or sought to open a previous file, Lisa would begin a sort of visual interrogation, requiring the user to click off the answer to three questions. This came to be known derisively as the 20 questions interface, and though it was powerful in conducting searches, it actually was the front end of a mini database, some of the engineers considered it unwieldy. The more acerbic critics called it the 100 questions interface. The final straw came when Dan Smith, the main implementer of 20 questions, tested it on his wife, and she couldn't get it. He went to Atkinson, and with engineer Frank Ludolph, they began collaborating on something radically different. Since any change that late in the game could be costly, too costly for the marketers to consider without Valium, they proceeded with stealth. "Don't tell me what you're working on, but good luck," said Wayne Rosing, Lisa's director of engineering. With that vague sanction, the three engineers vanished, working mostly at Atkinson's house, until they re-emerged with the Desktop Manager, a totally new interface which possessed a degree of direct manipulation that surpassed anything ever seen at Xerox, ever seen anywhere. Icons took new importance on Desktop Manager. As the name implies, the desktop metaphor had fully flowered. Just as on the real-life desk stretching before the user, the virtual Lisa desk could be cluttered with documents, folders, and tools. If you wanted to clean it up, there was a command that rearranged things in orderly rows. The tiny hieroglyphs represented either a document, a folder, an application, even a floppy disk. When you wanted to begin a new document, you would use the mouse to reach over to a stack of blank papers, double-click, and a window would open, representing the page before you. Even the file delete function was integrated into the make-believe office. On the lower right corner of Desktop Manager was a picture of a trash can. Dragging a file over it would, in effect, delete the file. But not immediately. If you moved the cursor over the trash can and double-clicked, A window would open, and all the icons of the files you had just discarded would appear. You could drag any or all of them to safety. Only when new items were discarded would the trash can be figuratively taken to the dump. The ability to open a file simply by moving a mouse, sticking one's hand in cyberspace, and selecting an icon was amazing. Compare this to the task of opening a file in the oppressive operating systems that dominated the industry until Macintosh, CPM and DOS. Those command line systems forced you to type the entire name of the file you wanted to open. The number of characters in the file was severely limited, and often the names you assigned to the files were so cryptic that you would spend a few minutes pondering what it might contain. Julia 2? Who's Julia? Is there a Julia 1? And wouldn't solve the problem until you opened it up and saw its contents. If you mistyped a single character of the file, as I often did, the system would assume you were not opening a previous file, but beginning a brand new file with a typo as its title. And you would sit there, frozen, for 20 seconds that seemed eternal, as the computer went through its paces so you could then delete that unwanted file and try once more to get the file you desired. Have you ever gotten on an elevator on the 3rd floor, intending to visit someone on the 10th floor, and then, by instinct, pushed the lobby button and waited in rage and self-recrimination as the elevator began its irrevocable descent? Manipulating files on personal computers was worse, much worse. You went the wrong direction 5 times a day. But with Lisa, all you had to do was scan the monitor for your document and get it. The change was so significant that it actually changed the way people thought about their documents. No longer was there a barrier between them and their information. No stern homunculus of a code word was required to get your document. The document was right there. You could see it. The old way of thinking, the computer somehow stored vague chunks of information, and by operating them, you were some sort of accountant or data processor, no longer applied. When this power was extended on the Macintosh, the stage was set for a generalized rethinking of our relationship to information. The use of metaphor was so effective that at some point, it was no longer clear where metaphor ended and reality began. As linguists Lakoff and Johnson explained in Metaphors We Live By, reality itself can be shaped by metaphor. For instance, our acceptance of the metaphor argument is war and attendant expressions like attack a position, gain ground, indefensible, and so on can actually shape the way we conduct our arguments, like conflicts with winners and losers. But Lisa, and later Macintosh, used the power of the digital computer to exploit metaphor in an equally powerful manner. Most Macintosh users, observed Thomas D. Erickson of Apple's Advanced Technology Group, believe that when they move a document icon from one folder to another, they are moving the document itself. He goes on to explain that what really is happening is some bits are being changed inside the computer so that a pointer to the file is being moved. But I don't see why this negates the user's belief that they really are moving a document. Just because the motion occurs in cyberspace does not mean it is not real. What we are concerned with when we move a physical file from, say, a typewriter to a manila folder in a file cabinet is not the rag content of the paper, the stiffness of the folder, or even the paper is involved at all. We do it to move information from one location to another so we can retrieve it later. That's the essence of the action. For all practical purposes, when Macintosh users drag a document icon from one folder to another, they are moving a document. Just as when they drag an icon representing a file over a trash can, they are emphatically throwing out the file. Not just pretend throwing it out or virtually throwing it out. It's gone, just as lost as if you had tossed it into the wastebasket. Interestingly, when the desktop manager was submitted to user testing, the human guinea pigs who used both versions found neither of them easier to learn than the other. The error rates were about the same with both versions, too, but the testers all agreed that of the two, the later version was by far the more enjoyable to use. Tesler would hear comments like, "I like the little pictures." Atkinson's vindicated boss presented the desktop design triumvirate t-shirts that read, "Rosing's Rascals." The Lisa interface was complete. All in all, Lisa was a spectacular achievement. Apple had spent $50 million in development, but as in a good Steven Spielberg flick, you could see all those dollars on the screen. Still, by the time Lisa was ready for its public rollout, even the designers knew that at the very least, Apple had a tough sell ahead. Lisa simply cost too much. The designers had once hoped to sell it at $2,000, but with every improvement, the price rose. The black-on-white display, bitmapping, mouse and windowing, multitasking, these all required expensive hardware and ate up huge gobs of memory. Lisa's ship with over 1,000 K bytes of memory, known as a megabyte, and that was barely enough. Lisa also proved unable to run adequately on floppy disk drives alone and had to be shipped with a hard disk drive, an expensive rarity for a personal computer of its time. The final cost? Over $12,000. And Lisa ran painfully slowly, not as slowly as the Xerox Star, perhaps, but still at a pace more glacial than frisky. It was not that noticeable in demos, but it was infuriating reality to those who used it. If Lisa had cost half as much and was several times as fast, perhaps Apple would have been able to market it successfully. And then again, perhaps not. Apple had never really learned to sell computers to Lisa's target, Fortune 500 corporations, and it did not start with Lisa. In January 1983, Apple announced Lisa. It did not actually ship until early spring. Steve Jobs and the newly hired president of Apple, John Sculley, traveled around the country, performing demos for the press and potential corporate customers. The media greeted Lisa warmly, noting that its steep price still represented a dramatic drop compared to what it might have cost previously for such an advanced example of technology. They hailed Jobs and wrote glowingly as well about Lisa's project manager, John Couch. They wrote almost nothing about key designers, Bill Atkinson or Rich Page. Everyone agreed that Lisa represented the future, but not the future of Apple. That would belong to a smaller project, working to create something referred to as Lisa's little brother, Macintosh. Chapter 5. In an industry where the term Renaissance man is tossed around as casually as a Nerf ball, the man who began the Macintosh project was the real thing. Jeff Raskin had degrees in computer science and philosophy. He was a musician, a former conductor of the San Francisco Chamber Opera Company. For 5 years, he had been professor of visual arts at the University of California at San Diego. He celebrated his resignation by getting in a hot air balloon and headed towards the residence of the chancellor, blowing melodies on a recorder as he wafted over the house. Next stop was Silicon Valley, where he wrote documentation for the booming personal computer industry. He also did some reporting for a chip-crazy publication called Dr. Dobbs Journal. His bio said, in part, that Raskin is well known for his heretical belief that people are more important than computers, and that computer systems should be designed to alleviate human frailties rather than have the humans succumb to the needs of the machine. One day in 1976, Raskin found himself in a garage in Los Altos that was the headquarters for a humble new startup company. It was even a humble garage. There was a workbench along the wall and parts all over the place. Sitting on a stool was a husky bearded guy named Steve Wozniak. And then in walked Steve Jobs. Raskin, at 33 years, was their senior in both age and experience. "They wanted me to write a manual for the Apple II," Raskin told me. "I was talking $50 a page. They talked $50 for the whole manual." Still, he agreed to the Steve's terms, and they presented him with an Apple II, serial number 2. Raskin wrote a literate manual that became a standard for the young industry. He accepted the job of Apple's Director of Publications, the company's 31st employee, officially joining the company, now formally incorporated, in 1978. He insisted on a clause in his contract assuring him that his duties would not interfere with rehearsals for the opera company. From the first, Raskin believed he knew more than his boss, Steve Jobs. The personal computer industry had its roots in hobbyism, wireheads and amateurs who were fascinated with the workings of machines. Apple was certainly no exception. In fact, as Raskin later told an interviewer, he purposely concealed from his new employers the fact that he held a degree in computer science. "If they had known," he said, "they might not have let me in the company, because there was such an anti-academic bias in the early Apple days." Wozniak was certainly in the seat of the pants engineering mold. And Steve Jobs? As far as Raskin was concerned, Jobs was no visionary, certainly not a skillful engineer, but a college dropout with an ego problem, a sponge who absorbed the ideas of others. Raskin, on the other hand, had a firm idea of what personal computers could be. They could enable people, if the people who designed them made intelligent choices. Before the hobbyists even integrated the word into their lexicon, Raskin was a student of interface, and he was hyper-aware that in terms of interacting with human beings, computers were woefully inadequate. He would say it bluntly, "I think personal computers are a pain in the neck." At first, Macintosh was Jeff Raskin's baby. He even named it. Raskin believed that bestowing a woman's name on a computer was a sexist act, a belief he freely shared with others. The Macintosh Apple was Raskin's favorite, and thus worthy of being a working code name. Ultimately, after some deft negotiating with McDonald's fast food chain on the status of trade names prefixed Mac, it became the computer's true name. The Macintosh was Raskin's reaction to another of Apple's mistakes, which he thought could have been prevented had the company listened to him, the overblown and overpriced capabilities of Lisa itself. But Raskin had himself to blame for the direction Lisa took. While a scholar at Stanford's AI lab, Raskin had spent some time hanging out at Park and was impressed with some aspects of the Alto interface. Two things about the Alto struck Raskin as brilliant. One was its bitmap display, allowing for the flexibility of type and graphics that one gets from the printed page. The other was its lack of modes. In early 1979, Raskin was working with the Lisa Group. He had, in fact, recruited one of his former students, Bill Atkinson, as its star programmer. At UC San Diego, Atkinson had been a participant in guerrilla theater productions organized by Raskin. As Raskin tells it, he was the one who first urged that the Lisa engineers go to Park to see the advanced display. Eventually, the notorious deal was cut, and Raskin accompanied the group on his historic visit. Before leaving Park, he told Larry Tesler, "We don't need this, but I'm glad they saw it." But he had underestimated the effect of Alto and Smalltalk on his colleagues, who were seriously blown away by the digital pyrotechnics. "As soon as that happened, I was dropped from Lisa," said Raskin of the Park visit. The next sentence was implicit. "Steve Jobs drove me out." As far as Raskin was concerned, it was just as well. As a result of bulking up to run bitmap Windows and multitask programs, Lisa was destined, in Raskin's view, to become too large and too expensive. Instead of bringing groundbreaking technology to Apple's core constituency, the people, it was destined to compete with dinosaurs, like the word processing systems of Wang or Lanier. "If I wanted to work for a business company, I'd join IBM," Raskin complained to Apple's president Mike Scott. "A computer can only be successful if it's accessible," Raskin believed. Raskin's idea was a computer that was really low cost, something that would not be very powerful, but would leverage its power so that truly useful tasks could be performed elegantly and efficiently. It would be a sharpshooter to the Lisa's bazooka-tier. Of course, Raskin did not use a munitions metaphor. His model was a modest yet essential tool, the Swiss Army knife. According to Raskin, Steve Jobs hated the idea of a simpler machine, so Raskin went to Mike Markula, who was then chairman of Apple. Markula, a former Intel executive whose money helped Apple get off the ground, was interested. He asked Raskin what he could design in the way of a $500 machine. "I said, nothing," recalled Raskin, "but for $1,000, I can give you something that could be dynamite." Raskin began to write in a loose-leaf binder he called the Book of Macintosh. It included design notes, a business plan, marketing ideas, and a philosophy. "The purpose of this design is to create a low-cost portable computer so useful that its owner misses it when it's not around, even if the owner is not a computer freak," wrote Raskin in January 1980. A month later, he mused, "The personal computer will come of age when it goes the way of the calculator or the telephone or probably both. It will become a nearly indispensable companion." The machine would be unlike anything Apple had yet produced, a one-piece tool that fit underneath an airline seat. It combined aspects of the Park philosophy, including the portability of the Dynabook, with the utilitarianism of the Apple II. But not a mouse. Raskin hated anything that took one's hands off the keyboard. You would flick it on, and it would be ready to use. The software for the only really important things you use the computer for, writing, calculating, files would be built in. You wouldn't even have to worry about which program you were using. You would simply work, treating the screen like a piece of paper. It would be as friendly to use as a toaster. Mastering Macintosh would be as simple as dropping a couple of pieces of whole wheat into the Sunbeam. When Raskin was scrawling his manifesto on the relatively hard-to-handle Apple II, most people likened the task of learning a computer to root canal work. Though no one wanted to do it, one day they might have to do it. If that unbidden calamity befell them, they would glumly accept what looked to be a hellish process. So what Raskin proposed actually seemed preposterous. The claim that he could deliver this unheard-of conviviality for under $1,000 was even more outrageous. Yet, in his exacting, almost pedantic manner, he was convinced that it would happen. And though he was ultimately destined to be a loser in the corporate politics that seethed underneath the surface of Apple Computer's dippy New Age culture, he was canny enough to get his pet project going. Operating with a degree of stealth so that the vulnerable young project would not draw the dangerous attention of Steve Jobs, Raskin gathered a small team to begin implementing Macintosh. The key hire was Burrell C. Smith, a diminutive blonde 22-year-old working in Apple's repair department. Smith had little formal training, a total of 10 courses at Foothill College, as he once described his education in electronics. But when it came to computer hardware, Smith was the natural. His idol was Steve Wozniak. Wozniak's creations in silicon were legendary. In particular, his work on the Apple II floppy disk drive was acclaimed as a masterpiece of technology. When more pedestrian engineers looked at the Woz disk controller, they saw confusing, almost counterintuitive leaps that somehow, almost miraculously, led to high performance. Smith saw haunting, almost divine logic. Every connection had its reason. It was a world where all was right. Smith felt comfortable in those worlds where logic ruled, and he loved to isolate himself from the messy loose ends of reality and devote all his creative energy to working in that logic-grounded realm. He felt like himself there. In a way, Smith's stint in Apple's repair department was like Lana Turner's possibly apocryphal presence at Schwab's drugstore. Both were waiting for stardom to tap them on the shoulder. Both got their wishes. Bill Atkinson was the one who put Smith and Raskin together. He brought the young engineer to Raskin's house one night and said, "Here's the guy who's going to design your machine for you." "We'll see," said Raskin, and after taking the measure of Smith, Raskin agreed. But it was the utterly Macintosh thing to do. At Xerox PARC, and even at the Lisa division at Apple, no one with such a scanty resume would have been asked to come up with the main logic design of the computer. Smith was elated. "It was the one chance of a lifetime to go through the cracks of the corporate culture," he once told me. "We raced through the elevator door just before it shut." This was the Macintosh team back then, a scrappy assortment of outcasts and mutts. It was an interesting pedigree. Instead of being handed down to the people from the gods of computer science, Mac was a bottom-up project generated by the actual hoi polloi. "We design products that we ourselves want to own," wrote Raskin. His challenge was to maintain his vision during the long struggle of product development. But first, he needed a prototype. "It was a statement of simplicity," said Smith of Raskin's vision, "of absolutely delivering the dream of a machine that you could just turn on. You don't have to have a machine that does everything in the world." It was to be a bitmap machine with a built-in display, built-in keyboard, and built-in file storage. In a move of ultra-cost consciousness, Raskin wanted the already obsolete cassette tape storage instead of a floppy disk drive. Over the 1979 Christmas holiday, Smith virtually lived inside the deserted Apple building, attempting to crank out a system that would fulfill Raskin's wish list. For parts, he scrounged around various offices and supply rooms, scavenging what seemed useful. For the central processing unit, CPU, the chip that was the center of all computer commands, he used Motorola's 6809, which was no more powerful than the CPU in the Apple II. After a week of work, he managed to build the main logic board. Early in the new year, he grabbed a soldering iron and inserted the board in an Apple II box. He finished the job late one night and went home, but before he did, he notified a friend of his in the Apple II division of the project's status. He added an informal challenge. Could the programmer get something to display on the screen? Then he would know his prototype worked. The programmer was Andy Hertzfeld. After the building was abandoned by day jobbers, Hertzfeld found his way to Burrell's desk and the prototype. He sat down at it, deciphered Smith's sketchy instructions on how it worked, and spent the entire night trying to conjure a picture on the screen. The next morning, Burrell Smith came in to see the Macintosh was alive. The image that Hertzfeld chose to display was indicative of the frivolity that would eventually be part of the machine's personality. It was a picture of Scrooge McDuck, underlined with a handwritten greeting, "Hi, Burrell." Despite the quick beginning, the effort moved slowly for much of 1980. Raskin was proceeding gingerly, aware that Macintosh was a sitting duck for cancellation. At a couple of points that year, the project actually got axed, and Raskin had to beg more indulgence. In September, a new software architect joined the small group, Guy Bud Tribble, a lean, tousle-haired programmer who had been teetering between a career in technology or medicine. Tribble had known both Raskin and Atkinson in San Diego and was well into a program in neurophysiology at the University of Washington that would lead to a PhD and an MD. But the prospect of denting the universe drew him to Macintosh, and he took a leave from Washington to work at Apple. His dissertation on feline neural disorders would wait. That fall, the group moved out of the main Apple building into an office on Stevens Creek Boulevard, referred to by the Mac people as the Good Earth, after the faux health food restaurant that stood in front. The five-person group shared a single room with a small anteroom to the side. In the center of the room sat a stack of cardboard boxes that had once held equipment. This was used as sort of a playroom. At the drop of a hat, everyone would stop work and throw Nerf darts at the boxes or engage in Frisbee matches. In the name of encouraging creativity, Raskin blessed those outbursts. The project was canceled again in October. Raskin begged Apple President Mike Scott for a 3-month reprieve. The team was still hoping to come up with something impressive enough to extend the project. Complicating matters was the progress of the Lisa. Apple was pouring millions of dollars into its design. In the wake of the park visit the previous year, Lisa was firmly on course to offer the first graphical user interface for a personal computer. Raskin, of course, would not consider something similar for his ultra-simple, ultra-cheap Macintosh. But others in the company were so enamored of the idea that they urged the Macintosh team to move in that direction. The first step would be the adoption of the same CPU chip that the Lisa used, the considerably more expensive Motorola 68000 processor. Bud Tribble, who was aware of the fantastic things his friend Bill Atkinson was writing for the Lisa team, urged that the Macintosh team follow suit. Tribble knew that to some degree he was betraying Raskin with his position, but he really believed it was best for the project. Ultimately, adopting Lisa technology would make Macintosh more the computer that he would like to own. But the chief proponent of this shift was Steve Jobs, whose disruptiveness had emboldened the engineers and executives on the Lisa project to bounce him off, with the blessings of Apple's chairman and president. Despite Raskin's efforts, Jobs came across the Book of Macintosh and was so impressed with Raskin's vision about a computer being as easy to use as a home appliance that it became part of Jobs' standard spiel for years thereafter. Jobs began to insinuate himself into the Skunk Works project behind the Good Earth, and Raskin's pure vision was as good as gone. "It was clear that Macintosh was the most interesting thing at Apple, and Steve Jobs took it over," said Raskin. The takeover proceeded by increments. Steve Jobs was not a technical wizard, but he thoroughly understood the mindset of the people who were. So when he tossed a challenge to Burrell Smith, daring the young engineer to design a prototype Mac for the 68000 chip, the job was a cinch. Despite knowing Raskin's mania for a low-priced machine, Smith rose to the bait and spent all of December 1980 to get it working. Raskin was not happy about the development, but Jobs outranked him. All Raskin could do was quickly recalculate the rock-bottom cost of manufacturing this new version of Macintosh. Smith got the prototype working by Christmas, almost a year to the day after his first effort. This was a remarkable enough achievement, but even more impressive were some of the tricks he used in the process. Back at Apple's main buildings, no less than 24 high-price engineers building the Lisa had taken 2 years to construct a carefully planned architecture around the 68000 chip, everything carefully charted and approved by committee. Smith, a true hacker and pack rat, spun his own version out with off-the-shelf parts and magic. It was not easy. Fitting the mighty Motorola 68000 to the rather modest framework of the Macintosh electronics was like strapping a jet engine to a Honda. Yet Burrell, using a technique called bus multiplexing, found a way to pull off the trick elegantly. He was able to draw the benefits of the microprocessor's power without overwhelming the Macintosh hardware. The result was the Smith's computer was more eccentric but ran twice as fast as the Lisa. This was all Steve Jobs needed to hear. The Macintosh, a computer designed to be as easy to use as an appliance, a computer that would cost thousands of dollars less than the Lisa, and even cost less than the comparatively dinosauric Apple II, could outrun the Lisa itself. Certainly a measure of revenge would belong to Jobs if he headed a design team that trumped the project from which he had been humiliatingly bounced. But there was something else at work. Steve Jobs was increasingly known as a national figure, the exemplar of the new age of entrepreneurism. Yet for years, he hated the fact that everyone in Silicon Valley considered the Apple II, the company's only truly successful product, to be solely the creation of his partner Steve Wozniak. This despite Jobs' brilliant idea that the computer should be packaged not like a wirehead hobby project, but a consumer product. Jobs instead was viewed as sort of a hustler, a slick marketer. This was a continual insult to Jobs, who yearned for respect in every way. Now he had the means to earn it. He would be the official leader of the Macintosh project. When Steve started coming over, Jeff's dream was shattered on the spot. Joanna Hoffman, the lapsed archaeologist whom Raskin had hired in November as the first marketing person on the team, later told me. It was difficult on everybody, and there was an allegiance to Jeff, but Steve had his own compelling aura. He immediately started talking about what it would look like, what it would feel like, how he would sell it. For the first couple of months in 1981, Raskin and Jobs tried to work together, but already two visions were clashing. Steve Jobs kept pushing for the Macintosh to be a smaller, affordable, sleeker version of Lisa, something so insanely great that it would actually bury the corporate computer that his company was spending $50 million to develop. Raskin kept fighting to keep costs lower, to keep focus tighter, to keep the goals more modest, basically to stave off the creeping Lisa-ism. Jobs immediately moved to put his mark on the Macintosh team itself. His new recruits were the people who had been the creative forces behind the Apple II, Rod Holt, the analog engineer, Jerry Manick, who had designed the now-familiar plastic casing, Randy Wigginton, who worked on the software, and even Steve Wozniak himself. The Macintosh project moved from the Good Earth to another location a few blocks from headquarters, nicknamed Texaco Towers, after a nearby gas station. Two leaders was one too many. Jobs claimed that Raskin's pace was too leisurely. At the rate he was going, there would never be a Macintosh. Jobs claimed that he could motivate the team to complete the project in little more than a year. Raskin, meanwhile, insisted that Jobs was incapable of running a successful project. According to Raskin, Jobs simply would not listen to people, would not consider alternatives, and could not make rational judgments. His style was imperious and overbearing. What had ruined Steve Jobs was his success. Even before turning 30, he had achieved fame and riches exceeding that of some truly great industrialists. "How can you believe any criticism when everything you do turns to gold?" asked Raskin. If Jobs were truly a genius or visionary, this wouldn't have been so bad, but Raskin thought Jobs really didn't know very much. How could a person be a leader if he constantly bludgeoned people on the team without even holding a solid idea of what should be done? An Apple vice president had once expressed a sentiment that Raskin considered accurate. You can't use the words Steve Jobs and manager in the same sentence. But it was Raskin himself who exercised that linguistic oxymoron in a memo to Apple president Mike Scott on February 19, 1981. While Mr. Jobs' stated positions on management techniques are all quite noble and worthy, in practice, he is a dreadful manager, wrote Raskin. By then, the game was just about over. Jobs had informed Raskin that his duties thereafter on the project he initiated should be limited to those of publications director. Raskin's response was to enumerate all of Jobs' failings as a project leader. He was late for appointments, he attacked people's work without understanding it, he sowed divisiveness and discontent, he played favorites, he had no idea of realistic scheduling. The memo was Raskin's burned bridge. He later claimed that it represented the sense of the entire team. "We were going to do it as a group, but others chickened out," he said, "and I was the only person who stood up to him." Thereafter, Raskin was off the project, and Steve Jobs was solely in charge. Officially, Apple's top officers had granted Raskin some time off from the project, but as it turned out, that was the end of his tenure at Apple. He quit within months. Some cynics thought that Markle and Scott allowed Jobs to have his way only because the Macintosh was a backwater, isolated from the company not only by geography, but in direction as well, a product deemed unlikely to succeed. In retrospect, the infighting between Raskin and Jobs was much more than a fleeting clash in the business world. The pushing and pulling had its effect on the finished product, which in turn affected the lives of literally millions of people. It was Raskin who provided the powerful vision of a computer whose legacy would be low cost, high utility, and a groundbreaking friendliness. Raskin was so protective of those qualities that he fought even the most obvious concessions to granting the machine more power. The processor he chose as the brain of his machine was clearly too feeble. The amount of digital memory he wanted was absurdly inadequate. Even though Jobs' version of the computer held twice as much memory, it was still woefully sparse. And his resistance to some of the Park innovations embodied in Lisa were as much based on pedantry as on a sure evaluation of what would make a computer easy to use. Jobs entered from the other extreme. As soon as he chose to be part of the Macintosh project, he demanded that the Mac take on a mouse, just like Lisa. Raskin was aghast. In his mind, the mouse was nothing more than a nuisance. Raskin believed that Jobs really didn't know what he was talking about. His conception of the Macintosh was fluid. It kept changing, he complained to me soon before the Mac launch. The last person who gets Steve Jobs' ear is the one he believes. Yet in the case of the mouse, it was Jobs who was correct. Not only is a Macintosh without a mouse now unthinkable, but most people agree that any personal computer is incomplete without a mouse, or at least a pointing device to perform the same job. A few years after leaving Apple, Raskin finally got the opportunity to put his own mouseless vision in play, starting a company called, significantly, Information Appliance. It made an extremely easy-to-use computer, eventually marketed as the Canon Cat. It made little impact on the computing world, and no dents whatsoever in the universe.